you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Jesse Russell back on the show. Jesse, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Tim. It's always an honor to be on. I'm enduring the, I guess, continued semi-lockdown like everyone else.
Now, where you are, it's a bit more, I think you have the more saner governors down there, right?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe it's kind of the last resistance of Northern tyranny.
South Dakota was with what's her name? Kristi Noem. She gave a speech recently about the coronavirus and liberty, and saying, she didn't do it. More or less, they didn't do anything out there, of course, and their numbers aren't any worse. In fact, they're better than many other states. So that's kind of a pattern there with this thing, with this operation. They've produced or made this sort of this cult of the mask, so as a symbol of compliance and mind control, so they can continue with the operation. I heard it was in Illinois because of a spike in tests, positive tests, which they call cases. They're preventing restaurants from serving people inside, so people will have to dine outside in the Illinois winter this year in Chicago.
Oh my goodness.
You know, yeah, this is just a pretext for shutting down these businesses. It's economic warfare. At this point, it's pretty obvious for all those who have eyes to see and a mind to think with. But the whole point is to keep the mask on and turn the mind off. So you just comply with this operation.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly enough, that is kind of a segue into some of the things I wanted to talk about this evening. Several people have asked me, it seems kind of strange that a lot of traditionalist and conservative Catholic media today, especially the past 2 years, some of these organizations, maybe the past, we could say 5 years or 6 years, that they've looked a lot like the Breitbart homepage. And so you click on them and you mostly get political issues, especially really pressing for the reelection of President Donald Trump in 2020. And I think that from my research, to the best of my opinion, that there has been a marked influence of some of these kind of populist figures, not only in traditional Catholic media, but in some traditional Catholic groups as well. If you notice the tone or tenor of some of these groups and some of these publications have sort of toned down more controversial red-pilled issues they've kind of avoided or tried to skirt around. And they've pretty much, at least some of them, have become mouthpieces of the Trump administration, which seems a little bit odd. And my thesis is going to be basically just as the sort of backers behind President Trump and the official populist movement utilized the alt-right in 2016 to get President Trump elected, there has been a new strategy now to utilize especially traditional Catholicism as at least one of the vehicles to press for President Trump's re-election in 2020 and kind of support the right-wing side of the deep state.
So the dialectic is being played here.
Absolutely. And I think that it's interesting. And this, as I told you before we went on air, I'm going to throw a couple curveballs and kind of trigger some people. It seems to be, from my research, that this dialectic is playing out in the church. So it's not so much a, you know, resistance of these heroic traditionalist bishops and, you know, priests, although there are certainly are heroic traditionalist priests that are out there. But it's kind of a battle between these two political entities in the church. I think it's a battle also, even just sort of reading about the state of Israel, its relationship to China, all the dust up about Benjamin Netanyahu, that not just in the church, but in Israel, in the United States, in Europe, in Great Britain, it seems to be that these two forces in the deep state are at war with one another. Now, maybe, you know, there is some dark room like in the X-Files where all these guys are smoking and they're controlling both sides of the dialectic. But I think at least on one level that this is a genuine fight.
So factions within the ruling elite or cabal who presume they're on the world is different, as you would expect, though, I guess. There's been some speculation that the reason why the Jeffrey Epstein case blew up into the mainstream press was a battle within Israel, the Netanyahu versus Barak faction.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that there was an article I was reading where Mike Pompeo, now, usually we think, probably most of your listeners think, well, Israel or, you know, whoever's behind Israel controls the United States. I don't doubt that there is a lot of truth to that. But Mike Pompeo was scolding Israel for its relationship with China. And this might trigger some people, but I wouldn't totally discount the idea of some sort of Anglo-American faction that is not totally subservient to Israel.
Well,
I could be
that's
wrong
not,
about
I mean,
that.
As recently as the George H.W. Bush administration, there was a lot of resistance to Israel. That's and that was the early 90s. And some attributed his defeat to Clinton was George H.W. Bush's hesitancy to support the Israeli agenda, the Zionist agenda.
Yeah, I think – I forget which – if I was on your show or who it was. But in his official biography by John Meacham, President H.W. Bush was quoted as saying, what can I do? I'm just one man against the Israel lobby.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Bushes were the old WASP, you know. Elite, that ran things, that sort of went into decline in the late 1970s. And in the 70s, you had Jewish ascendancy.
Yeah,
really, it was after the Six-Day War, but I guess it took another decade. You know, again, you had the death of the Rockefeller brothers in the late 70s. You know, Nelson dying in, I guess it was like 78 or 79, and then the other one in 79. And I think at the same time, you know, you had the cultural ascendancy of Jewish cultural ascendancy in the latter half of the 1970s was clear. And it sort of is a question of whether, I mean, there's always the Anglo-American Zio Empire, and there's a question, you know, were the Jews a junior partner in this? And there's always been some debate about that. And you, of course, the idea of crypto Jews and also the integration of sort of Jewish banking families into the British establishment in the 19th century, into the British elite, muddies this terrifically. And to this day, there's always some talk about crypto this, crypto that. You know, I heard some people even say that Henry Ford was a crypto Jew, which is, you know, astonishing to most people's ears. But the idea was, it all goes into this controlling and manipulating the dialectic, you know.
Yeah, there may be some truth to some of those claims. I do think that, you know, when it comes down to it, like, there are, you know, several centers of power, and it has a lot to do with class. I think obviously the bloodlines thing is important. I think it was Jay Dyer said this, that a lot of, you know, that guy Fritz Springmeier, kind of a 1990s or 2002 tier, like, conspiracy theorist. But there are some stuff in his book, Illuminati Bloodline, supposedly it just is in totally from outer space. But there's some substance to that. And I've heard lots of rumors about that. The idea that there are ethnic European families that are like ancient, or people from the Near East that are not necessarily Jewish, but that are part of, you know, the absolute top of the pyramid. And it's not, I could be wrong, in my mind, it's not just one ethnic group that's calling the shots. I could be wrong about that. I'm not defending anyone. I'm not discounting all the evidence to support the influence of one specific group. But I want to go back to 2014 real quickly and a talk that Steve Bannon gave at the Vatican for a organization called the Human Dignity Institute. Now, I'll say this. I had never really followed a lot of Steve Bannon before fairly recently, but I think on one level, he's a genius. I mean, just to listen to him talk, it's really impressive. Usually a lot of people, especially in the alt-right, mock him and stuff and whatever. But I think there's a genius to Steve Bannon. I don't know his heart and what his motives are and who he really ultimately serves. I'm just going to try to present the facts as best I can and let people decide what they think. But he gave this talk. Again, this is 2014. This is before Brexit. This is before the Trump phenomenon. This is before you know, the reaction against Pope Francis. And really, when the Catholic traditionalist movement or the neo-traditionalist movement really got up on its legs. But he gave this talk, and he talked about to a Catholic audience about a global Tea Party movement. And he praised the UKIP and the Front National in France. Now, the Front National is, you know, political observers, you know, especially among your audience will know, has undergone a marked change. They used to be a lot more, I guess we could say, right wing under Jean-Marie Le Pen. And then under his daughter, they've kind of rebranded themselves as a kind of populist group. And it's interesting that Bannon was praising them. And he also presents, and this will come in a little bit later, something important. He keeps repeating the term Judeo-Christian West. He repeats it probably, I don't know, 10 times in a relatively short, at that time it was a Skype speech. So one of the things that Bannon and the right wing of the deep state is trying to do is present this idea of conservative Catholic Protestants and Jews fighting together. Now, the other side, of course, of the left wing of the deep state, it's like Christianity and Islam united together. And I think, you know, Pope Francis at least seems on one level supportive of that movement. Another thing Bannon praised in the speech was capitalism. And he used a term which he calls enlightened capitalism. Now, that sounds somewhat like the term democratic capitalism that Michael Novak developed, allegedly drawing from the work of Irving Kristol, Two Cheers for Capitalism. So he presents this idea of a global movement that's going to be pro-capitalist, it's going to be Judeo-Christian, and it's going to be anti-Islamic. The enemies are Islam and this secularists. He uses the term even Islamic fascism, which was popular in the counter jihad period. And he mentions, and this will kind of come in importantly in a second, about the importance of gathering together this big right wing movement. And what they're going to do is going to kind of burn through or purify themselves of any radical right, or they didn't use the term alt-right then, but any sort of like ethnocentric movement. So Bannon basically lays out this plan.
This is like Buckleyism.
It seems to be. He condemns specifically libertarianism. He says, like, I'm not going to support that form of capitalism. He doesn't support crony capitalism. So he's very much talking about the 2008-2009 economic crisis. I think it is a rebranding of a mutation of Buckleyanism and neoconservatism. So
yeah, I'm thinking of that, you know, Buckley's article in Commonweal in 1952 about except pretty much the, the paleo right, either, being kicked out of the conservative movement, Republic out of power, and sort of accepting the terms of the Cold War with, CIA, big government for the duration of the conflict. And so no longer any radical fringe ideas about constitutionalism and limited government. We have a water fight, right? So.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting too that he sort of says that he is going to that they're going to need to pick up some of these right-wing people, because all the people asking questions in the audience he's responding to is like, what about the racists and whatever and all these right-wing groups? And so Bannon helped to found, obviously Breitbart News. And it's interesting that Breitbart itself was there's an article in Breitbart News in this that same year, 2015, Breitbart News Network, Born in USA, Conceived in Israel by Larry Solove. And in there, he talks about going to Israel, and they found Benjamin Netanyahu was there. There's a famous picture you've probably seen. It's Andrew Breitbart, some other people, and Benjamin Netanyahu is kind of like looking, he's turning around. And Larry Soloff, one of the main people at Breitbart, says, "One thing we specifically discussed that night was our desire to start a site that would be unapologetically pro-freedom and pro-Israel. We were sick of the anti-Israel bias of the mainstream media and J Street. By launching Breitbart Jerusalem, the journey comes full circle and the promise between two friends is fulfilled. And in a very real sense, Breitbart News Network returns to its roots." So we know that Bannon had planned this idea of a resurgence on the right, and his colleagues and at Breitbart had argued that Breitbart is going to be this very strongly pro-Israel organization. In fact, one of the reasons for Breitbart's founding is to present propaganda in support of Israel. And if you remember when Steve Bannon, there was like some of his divorce court documents were released, and he allegedly had made a comment about the Jewish people at the school his kid went to, something like that. And all these Breitbart writers came out defense of Bannon, how much he supports Israel and how much he supports the Jewish community. So the role of the right wing of Israel and its use of media, American media and Western media, to promote the survival of Israel is an integral part of this neo-populist movement. And Salvini, the guy, Viktor Orban, Nigel Farage, and Donald Trump are all pro-Israel. And we'll get a little bit this more detail in this for in a second. Anyone in that dissident right movement who's not pro-Israel eventually ended up being kicked out or ashamed or marginalized in some form. And as we'll talk about in a little bit, it's this movement more recently has seized control, in my view, of at least certain branches of Catholic media.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that they would, I guess, characterize or describe mainstream media coverage as being anti-Israel. I guess that even the most mild criticism or news coverage of some atrocity being committed by IDF, they construe as being anti-Israel. It's that typical overreaction you get.
You know, what's interesting is there was a book written by Yoram Hazani in 2018, The Virtue of Nationalism. And in there, he talks about how great America is, how great England is, how great Holland is for some reason, and the Protestant countries that became nationalist countries. And he really hates the EU, Yoram Hazani does. Why? Because he saw it as an extension of the medieval German Empire, or but I think the point was he sees this as a rival to Israeli interest. And I don't so I think that this populist group hates the European Union and the European left, in which you do have a lot of at least until fairly recently, there was strong criticism of Israel in the left, especially in the UK. And it wasn't just sort of pandering to the Muslim constituency in Great Britain. And I don't know if you remember, there was like a Norwegian journalist who was injured in Palestine. So there was a great deal of sympathy. I mean, America, not as much, but in the European left, there's a lot of sympathy toward Islam and a lot of sympathy toward Palestine. So that could be what they're talking about. But
even the British Labour Party was accused of being anti-Semitic, you know, recently.
Who's the guy? Jeremy Corbyn, who was running. So, I mean, I think that's a big part of it, is that whatever this coalition is, one of the enemies is Islam. Why? Well, Islam is to a certain degree a threat to Europe through migration, without a doubt. I mean, even, you know, I've been to Europe a number of times and seeing parts of, you know, our, at least for on this world, our ancestral homeland, basically colonized. And that there are parts of, you know, beautiful ancient cities that our ancestors built that have been taken over without any fight at all. I'm not encouraging fighting or something like that. But yeah, absolutely, Islam is a threat, but it's especially a threat to Israel. And so if Breitbart News Network was founded to defend Israel, then those associated with it that are pushing all these political movements, that's going to be one of their key goals, is attacking Islam and defending Israel.
There's a certain contradiction there, because, you know, Jewish organizations are heavily involved in the weaponized migration that Europe's been subjected to in the past, you know, couple decades. And, of course, a large chunk of that population is bringing Muslim populations into traditionally, you know, Christian or post-Christian societies. And so I don't know, is there a tension between what they see as Islam as being a threat and also their ultimate desire to destroy Western civilization, what they see as Christendom, or, you know, sort of the vestiges of Christendom?
Well, this is my theory on it. I think there is, in the Israeli right and the Jewish right in the United States especially, there are people, and I'll kind of avoid stepping on some toes, but there are people who finance different white nationalist groups who are Jewish. I think most of your listeners are aware of that. And I think those people identify as being part of Europe, those right-wing Jews. I think what they don't want is a, you know, ethnically European Christian organization that has a tremendous amount of power, because like the, you know, J-Left, they are also, you know, concerned, because that when we have power in the past, and I'm not buying into this myth of like 2,000 years of persecution or something, but when we have had power in the past, we were able to, you know, either expel, you know, Jewish people from, you know, countries, or to, you know, keep them in the ghetto. Although it's interestingly, in the Jewish neoconservative Norman Poderitz's book, Why Are Jews Liberals? He admits that the rabbis during the Middle Ages would encourage the Jewish people as well to stay segregated.
Yeah, maintain solidarity and group cohesion through segregation, and also through, I guess, encouraging through the Talmud behavior, which would incite or create, you know, animosity among the host culture, and then you could play the victim, which is what the, you know, is what they've done, you know, for centuries, playing the victim, and that's how their interpretation of their narrative history has been used to create inordinate or you know, disproportionate Jewish power, both culturally and politically, throughout the West. And that's just there for all to see now. Look at the laws, you know, that are passed now, particularly in the EU, where they don't have, you know, a First Amendment right there in many of these countries. And Germany was first, but now all throughout Europe, these laws are being passed to ban, you know, essentially free political speech, questioning certain narratives or aspects of historical narratives, you know.
Yeah, it's and again, I think it is more complicated than just being one group. I could be wrong about that. I want to kind of jump to another figure who is influencing Catholic media today, and is kind of has a relationship, especially with the Catholic blogger and vlogger Taylor Marshall. And that is Jack Posobiec. If you remember, he's usually identified as being someone in the alt-right, but he worked as a naval intelligence officer from 2012 to 2018. And I always, whenever I encounter that in research, someone worked for military intelligence or naval intelligence, or we're talking about the author of The Exorcist who'd worked for some sort of Air Force intelligence. Like, just there's something that's a red flag. In fact, Prosobiec allegedly worked at Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, like Bob Woodward, right? Working for Naval Intelligence.
Yeah, it's definitely a red flag. I mean, once a spook, always a spook. I'm not accusing him of being some sort of intelligence asset. Prosobiec interestingly spent his honeymoon in Israel, though. But he was integral in 2015, 2016 in recruiting people to the alt-right, similar to, and we'll kind of go back to Steve Bannon in a second, to get people. He was working for an organization called Citizens for Trump that was allegedly tied to Roger Stone. He appeared at a Barnes & Noble in 2016 with Roger Stone, and he helped recruit allegedly Richard Spencer and was trying to get, was part of this effort to get, and it sounds like a contradiction, this effort through this neo-populist group to get the alt-right to support Trump in 2016. In fact, I have a quote somewhere in my notes where Bannon is corresponding with Milo Yiannopoulos, and he's like insisting on the importance of social media. So I think Bannon is a genius. He knew, he saw the potential of the alt-right in 2016 to affect the election. And so these people, Milo, Prosobiec, were sent out there to, at least in my view, in my opinion, from my research, to recruit these more extreme alt-right people, like Bannon said he was going to do in that 2015 speech, and get them to get Trump into office. Why? Who is the greatest friend of Israel that's ever sat in the Oval Office? Who, outside of Lyndon Johnson, I guess, who has given a key, I believe, to the White House, a symbolic key to Benjamin Netanyahu? Donald Trump. So this was an effort to get Trump in office. Prosobiec was sent there. Now, interestingly, kind of jumping ahead, Prosobiec has had some back and forth with Taylor Marshall, who is head of Catholics for Trump, and who is author of Infiltration and author of an interesting book called The Crucified Rabbi. And I don't know if we'll get to this in notes eventually, but it's my conspiracy theory that The Crucified Rabbi was written to kind of sideswipe E. Michael Jones's work, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. I think there are a number of books that have been written in response to that by official Catholic media to kind of sideswipe that. Another figure that Marshall has had some Twitter interaction with is Mike Cernovich, who also seems to be someone who reached out to Richard Spencer in 2016 and was trying to get him to support Trump. Another figure that did this, who eventually ended up kind of snitching to the SPLC on the alt-right, was Katie McHugh. I don't know if you saw those kind of famous articles that came out, I think a couple years ago, I believe, who kind of doxed a bunch of people in the Trump administration who were alt-right. But she had worked for Breitbart. I don't know what role she had played in recruiting, but she kind of provided a lot of inside baseball of what was going on there in this effort to kind of bring in the alt-right, at least temporarily. Now, I have a conspiracy. I think, I don't know to what degree that Charlottesville was intentionally set up, but it was extremely effective in accomplishing of what Bannon wanted, which was purging the mainstream populist right of its more extremist elements. Because right after that, everyone could kind of backpedal and say, oh, we have no association with the alt-right. But interestingly, though, Bannon himself eventually was kicked out of the Trump administration, too. So I don't know if that's where he himself became too hot to handle. I don't really have any insider baseball on that.
What about the strange death of Breitbart? Was that 2015?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have the date on that. I guess I should have pulled it up. I've heard different theories that he had some sort of Obama revelation of some kind. I don't know how true that is.
You never know if he's doing that. I mean, you never know, because Obama has, you know, all ties to Chicago, organized crime, Jewish mafia, the Pritzkers, and you know, all types of scandals. So. You know, he left an event and he just, I guess, suffered a massive heart attack on a street corner, despite having no apparent health problems. And that's always kind of suspicious, given the fact that, you know, they boast about having heart attack guns, you know.
Yeah, well, it seems to be this crowd. I mean, Cernovich in Prosobiec with Pizzagate in 2016, and then more recently the stuff about Hunter Biden's laptop. Mm-hmm. That I don't know in the end. I think with Pizzagate, it seemed to be there was something weird going on. I wrote a couple articles about the Podesta brothers' art collection and stuff like that. They were definitely strange characters. I don't know to what degree the Pizzagate thing is true or not, or the Hunter Biden thing, but this is definitely one of the MOs of this group is to either find some incriminating or perverse thing of their enemies, or find something like that and exaggerate it, or totally make it up wholesale. I don't know exactly which one. So, like I said, the rumor was there was something Andrew Breitbart had that they didn't want being released.
Yeah, I mean, you also had that wasn't too long after Michael Hastings had his strange car accident in Los Angeles. The reporter. The car went out of control, and it was in a fiery car wreck. And the car exploded, and they said it exploded because he had a substance abuse problem or something. I don't know. It didn't seem to make much sense. But he had been run afoul of Stanley McChrystal or something, some of the news reports. But you have this string of strange deaths, you know. But of course, then, you know, just journalists and people only assassinated in Russia. And in the United States, they just have these strange deaths, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Another figure that comes up is Milo Yiannopoulos, who himself was docked. He gave this kind of vile speech about underage young men or older boys. And so it seems to be with some of these, like, it is really, as James Jesus Angleton said of the CIA, a wilderness of mirrors, mm-hmm. with these groups. Like, who is doing this? Is this a left-right fight? Is this a struggle for power? All these people, Milo, Steve Bannon, I think a lot of these Catholic figures as well, at least some of them, they want power for its own sake. And so if we were living in, like, Soviet Russia, they would be the most dedicated commissars you could imagine. Or if we were living in, like, Nazi Germany or something like that, they would be the most fanatical Nazis there were. I think some of these figures, at least, they know where power is, and they're smart, and they know how to get it. And other ones are more ideological, where they will die for Zionism, or they will die for Catholicism. But it seems to be different levels of power struggle. I mean, my theory is that, you know, they wound the alt-right up, and then it just got out of control.
Like, as you would expect.
Yeah.
The situation is dynamic, and it's not like you can control it and move around chess pieces on a board. You're dealing with people, and people aren't just objects. They don't always respond the way you want them to respond. Then you have to improvise and change and do something a little different. And, you know, but as far as sort of this balance of terror and mutual blackmail, I mean, I think that's kind of how much of the establishment fight it out. That's why you can have a Speaker of the House be exposed as a pedophile, and despite the fact you look at his career, it was known long ago that that he had these proclivities. Yet he rose politically. He rose not despite it, but because of it. And I can have to imagine each faction has control files and dirt on everybody else, and they kind of check each other. And you saw that going back into the early part of the mid part of the 20th century with J. Edgar Hoover and the information he had on people and the information that the mafia had on J. Edgar Hoover, and so everyone was kind of compromised. And then you talk about Roy Cohn and his connections to Senator McCarthy and also to Donald Trump. In later years. But Roy Cohn, I think it was Detective Rothstein, New York Gold Shield detective, who was involved in the Son of Sam investigations, also the child trafficking in New York. And he investigated that, and that sort of brought him into the realm of politics because this was being used to compromise people. And Roy Cohn was involved in that. And some people have said that Roy Cohn had a control file on a lot of people. This was the source of his power. And he was tied into the Jewish mafia, the political establishment, and he had people like Cardinal Spellman compromised. And this is how you get all the wonder why the system seems to be so I guess alien from the interest of the people and controlled, manipulated, is because ultimately these people who we think have power, you would think would represent some sort of heterodox or separate powers within the system to fight, to fight the forces of globalism. Why they can't do that? Because they're ultimately they're compromised. They don't have the independence we think they do to speak out and do what we think they should do. Might explain why the Catholic Church has been so weak in the face of this COVID scam.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too, that one of the figures that shows up here is Ben Shapiro, and he's kind of an enemy of Breitbart. I know he broke away from Breitbart. I don't know if he represents a separate separate entity, a separate Israeli interest, that some of these figures like Ali Alexander, who is a populist operative who's gone after Kamala Harris, and who again with the Catholic journalist Taylor Marshall has had some tweet interaction and is supposedly himself now a Latin Mass Catholic. It's interesting that I think that the right wing of the deep state, they see what happened, that all these Catholics have gone from being JP2 Catholics and neoconservatives, and that they're done with that. And so now you have all these traditionalist Catholics who are confused and they're kind of scared or whatever. But I think that there's an attempt to kind of control that, because within traditionalism is essentially reactionary, usually. Mm-hmm. It's very skeptical of Jewish power. It's very anti-modern, anti-liberal, in a certain sense, anti-American, in the sense of being anti-liberal or anti-Enlightenment. And that is not acceptable. It's okay to go to Latin Mass, even though when you go to it, it's this ancient ritual that is very reactionary in itself. But what they don't want, and this kind of happened with the publication First Things, where they started presenting critiques of capitalism. They wrote a favorable book review of the, I think it was the diaries of the boy, Edgar Mortaro, who Pius IX had taken and raised in the Vatican after he was clandestinely baptized by his Christian housekeeper. He was a Jewish boy. And First Things, it seems to me, have been gotten reined in. So I think, yeah, that the church is this huge, enormous organization. There is no great Catholic monarch. There is no Catholic emperor to present political power. So the options in our post-American multipolar world is the Anglo-American establishment and its influence in the EU. There's Russia. There is the Islamic world, which is, of course, divided itself. And there's China. And all of these organizations have tremendous power. And the church has very little political power, but it has a great deal of cultural power. And you have all these Catholics in a tailspin. And if you go to them and say, if you're traditionalist, you're fighting this great, like Steve Bannon gave this talk to the Remnant Newspapers conference, Catholic Identity Conference. It's like, you're the vanguard of the civilization. We're going to be in this for the long haul. And China's bad. China's bad. It's terrible. All these liberals are meeting at Davos. We are under attack as Catholics. Pope Francis has sold out the United States to China. Cardinal McCarrick was part of that process of selling out the United States to China. That's an interesting point, that maybe that's why McCarrick was, hit. He was also part of the Obama State Department's somehow connected with the trips to Iran to work on the Iran deal. So Cardinal McCarrick, was very much tied to the left wing of the deep state, and that's why he's sort of an enemy. So yeah, it's almost like the church is being used as this vehicle to push political machinations, and that it serves as kind of like a battleground as well. These two global forces are fighting.
That would appear to be similar to David Wimhoff's thesis in his book on the Catholic Church and the CIA in the Cold War period, how the church was subverted by the CIA, as many other churches were, but the church being the largest, having the largest global reach, any other church, was used to promote Americanism post-war immediate Cold War era. And and there was a similar battle back then between the traditionalists or the Catholics versus the Americans, like, I guess represented by John Courtney Murray. I guess in Vatican II was the point where it was infiltrated by various interests to promote their agenda. One was again was promoting Americanism, the separation of church and state. These are all Masonic principles, and also with Nostra Aetate, and also you had what's his name, Malachi Martin, working for B'nai B'rith, promoting that. And it was at that point when Catholic cultural power seemed to be at its peak going into the 1960s. But as David Wenhoff points out, there were troubles, because this is the ultimate problem was Americanism and the American ideology, which is I guess counter to traditional or Catholic teachings. Idea of separation of church and state, and the fact that the church in the 1960s abandoned the idea of the confessional state as being ideal.
Yeah, and so and what happens? You and I have talked about this in the past. What happens? Well, then all of a sudden we're like anti-Islam, which the church is not. There's been a long struggle with Islam, but during the late '90s and then the War on Terror, there's all these Catholic neoconservative books about what Islam is, and then that kind of peters out. There is the Summorum Pontificum of Benedict XVI. There's the Obama era, and there's the Trump era, and this shift of Catholics further right. And the worst thing imaginable would for there to be an authentic presentation of Catholic social teaching, which would not advocate for laissez-faire economics and usury. It would not argue for a liberal democracy as an ideal. You can have a Catholic republic. I mean, Leo XIII wrote in support of a Third Republic of France that was, if I remember correctly, a Catholic republic. So he said the monarchy is ideal. And St. Thomas Aquinas, drawing from Aristotle's commentary on the Spartan constitution and then also the feudal system Aquinas was in, argues for this mixed regime, this kind of, of your monarch and aristocrats and, those below them. But something like that is obviously not going to happen tomorrow. But there's a need to kind of control the Catholic vote. Because, if we look at someone like Trump, who's been openly in support of gay marriage, and then the other side is supportive of gay marriage. In the past, I believe, if I remember correctly, Trump supported abortion. Supposedly he changed his view. Okay, fine, maybe. But those old kind of pro-life or Cold War issues don't quite work with President Trump, because they don't seem to fit into him well. I'm not saying they necessarily did for the Bushes or Reagan or anyone else. I don't know, their personal beliefs or whatever, but there's definitely been a rebranding. This idea like China is going to come get us. So obviously I'm not supportive of the Tricoms or something like that. But and interestingly, my home state of Montana, there's like I was talking to some people that they bought up like land where there's mining and agriculture and that sort of thing. So yeah, China is the Chinese communists are a threat. But it's deflecting from other things. I have another book here. I'm kind of jumping ahead of my notes, but it's by a guy named Paul Kenger. And I honestly believe this book was written. It's called The Devil and Karl Marx: Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration. So obviously that's true. Communism did that. But I do believe this book was written, because he talks about Wilhelm Reich and he talks about the Sexual Revolution, the Frankfurt School. This book was one of many, possibly Taylor Marshall's book Infiltration, and possibly his book The Crucified Rabbi, that was meant to counter the influence of people like E. Michael Jones. I mean, I don't agree with Dr. Jones on everything, but I think a lot of these books were kind of pushed by these presses. And if you notice, like Tan Books, which is a traditionalist Catholic publishing house, was bought up by St. Benedict Press. And those who are listening are traditional Catholics. I just like ask them to take a look at some of these publications, these traditionalist publications, the things they're pushing, which they never would have. Terms like freedom and Americanism and Trump's going to save us. I mean, is that really true? I mean, perhaps. I mean, that Trump will be this great sort of secular savior, but I doubt it. I truly do. He may be the lesser of two evils. I'm not telling people who to vote for, but I think there's definitely an attempt to seize the traditionalist movement and to change it. And I think that's largely been successful, at least on the level of journalism and print, and then also in at least some of these traditionalist organizations.
Yeah, to I guess steer it in a direction that will serve immediate political interest.
Absolutely.
The president and also the... I've read some of Infiltration, and I've watched some of Till Marsh's stuff and his material. And in Infiltration, he talks a lot about communism, Marxists, Freemasonry.
Yeah.
And Archbishop Vergano does this too. He talks about
yeah.
And this is sort of, I think it's an over mystification of the problem, because when you hear Freemason, you think about people, you know, ceremonies and playing ping pong and in the lodge, whatever. Obviously, it's more involved than that. Freemasonry is a technology or method for maintaining private networks of subversion and also, covert political control. But largely, you can make the case that now Freemasonry, it's not operationally relevant anymore. I think it's more of a philosophy and method of control, and the world itself has become a lodge. Just the fact that so much of the modern world is Freemasonry, but Freemasonry itself at its source was it's very Jewish. When you blame Freemasons for the problems in the church and society, you're over-mystifying it, and you're not addressing groups, and there are specific groups and organizations that you can target for your criticism. E. Michael Jones does that. Namely, he calls it, you know, the Jewish revolutionary spirit. And he's saying this is the problem. And this is the problem with the church today is that because it can't use that language, it is essentially neutered in the culture war. Because in order to fight the culture war, fight the enemies of the church and by definition, enemies of of civilization, and also enemies of Christ, the logos of the universe. You have to identify the enemy, and part of the enemy, historically, as E. Michael Judgman's case, is the Jews, because they rejected Christ, and this their rejection of Christ meant that they rejected the logos, the meaning of the universe, and they became revolutionaries, and this has reverberated throughout history, but up until after 1945, because of certain historical narratives, certain events, attacking Jewish power directly is no longer considered polite, and now it can. You can't have a career if you do that. And I think the last person, public figure, to direct Jewish power directly was Charles Lindbergh.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and maybe Father Coughlin. But this is the problem. This is how E. Michael Jones, I was interviewing him a while back. He was talking about how in his church, the bishop there hosted a display an orchestra where they were playing violins supposedly used by the orchestra at Auschwitz cases at the church. And he made the point, and we both made the point, is if your bishop is doing this, he's not going to be in a position rhetorically or even psychologically to combat Jewish power and the role that Jews have in the culture war, particularly moral subversion of society, which they openly talk about. They call it liberation. They call it, it's tikkun olam, it's revolution, it's reforming the world. But, you know, whether it's gay marriage or abortion, LGBTQ stuff, pornography, and if the church is stuck criticizing secular radicals, you know, or Freemasons, they're not going to be able to wage the war that needs to be waged to turn things around.
Well, interestingly, yeah, I guess I'll jump to the part of my notes about Taylor Marshall. I mean, he himself, there's an article, he took it down, where he claimed to be ethnically Jewish, mm-hmm. which is fine. I mean, just because someone is that, it doesn't mean they're necessarily...
Yes, it's a theological construct. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's fine. But he, I have two things here. One, I'll give credit where credit is due. I sent you one of these things. It's at this blog, callmejorgebergoglio.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. it's I've corresponded with that guy in the past. He is a state of a contest. Some of them either he said some of the guys write for him or not. I'm not a state of a contest. I'm not saying I support everything on there. I also have my own notes. I'll kind of go over for first. So 2008, a famous book came out by someone by the name E. Michael Jones. It was called The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Now, there were a number of books released possibly in response to this. The date I have for The Crucified Rabbi of Taylor Marshall's is 2009. There's another book called Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist by a guy named Brant Petrie. And on its the audio version, they have a host over a hexagram. So, I mean, you could write these books, and I don't want to quibble about titles. People have, like, you know, articles I've written that they've, you know, the titles, they've critiqued them. But why would you, first of all, before we get into the text themselves, like, why would you write an article like that? Why not just say the biblical roots of the Eucharist, mm-hmm. or the biblical roots of Christianity, which is obvious, right? So Taylor Marshall's work, Judaism and the Origin of Christianity, talks about a number of things. And I'm pretty sure he wrote this, I could be wrong, in my opinion, in response to a red-pilled Catholic who had read The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. So in this work, he seems to say two different things at the same time. He says, you know, some good things. To disagree with Zionism or Israeli politics is not anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Okay, true. One can be opposed to the Jewish Talmud. Zionism, Israeli politics, and even the Jewish religion without hating Jews or seeking extermination. That's exactly right. However, throughout his work, he makes absolutely, as far as I remember, no mention of any of the points E. Michael Jones makes in Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And you walk away with the impression, he even quotes a scene in The Fiddler and the Roof where the Russians came and break up a Jewish wedding, that the 2,000 years together between Jews and Christians has been Christian persecution of Jews, end of story.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way it is.
That's that lachrymose, self-serving view, historical narrative, yeah.
And that he'll say that, you know, supersessionism, in an earlier edition of the book, he said that supersessionism was an error. And then he says he rejects it. He says, you know, that in order to be saved, the Jewish people have to ultimately become Catholics. However, there are points throughout his work where certain of his strong statements that are correct about Judaism seem blurred. He does note that there is a difference between the biblical Judaism of Moses and the Talmudic Judaism of the rabbis. However, most of the time when he's talking about Judaism in the book, he's using the present tense. So the Jews do this, we do that. Even though he says that there is, like supersessionism, and they're in the sense that, you know, the new covenant replaces the old or fulfills the old. He does say that the people of Israel continue to be a perpetual eschatological sign of God's love. They're a reminder that the gifts and calling of God is irrevocable. The preserving presence of Israel on earth. And again, I don't know if he's talking about the ethnic body or the country. Is perhaps the best proof that God exists and is a covenant extended to 1,000 generations. Now, there are certainly things in Christianity that Taylor Marshall could have used to say as being the best, you know, proof that God exists. And it seems to be in that quote that I mentioned that, you know, he seems to be hinting at that he might actually reject the theology of supersessionism, that he seems to say that this covenant continues on. And that's kind of what this whole discussion of Judeo-Christian, especially when it has Catholics as and other Christians as an audience, is trying to say, that Christianity and Judaism are, you know, the same religion, or that they're basically interchangeable, or that, you know, Jewish people follow the old law, or even if they don't follow the old law, just by being Jewish, that they are going to be saved. You know, Marshall does a couple points point out the need for them to convert, but there are other points where it's kind of like a little bit hazy. There's another line. He says, Gentiles should revere the Jewish people as kinsmen of Christ. The faith and flesh of Israel are integral to the humanity of the Redeemer. And this sort of language throughout this whole work seems to give the opposite impression that he announced that he was going to give the very beginning. And I honestly believe that this work was written. It was actually a collection of lectures he gave at the Opus Dei Catholic Information Center in Washington, D.C. I got that from Colme Jorge Bergoglio. But it seemed like, why is there a need to try to like use this language and say, well, you know, Catholicism is a lot like Judaism, using the present tense there. You know, it's my view that this work, like I said, was written as a response to the Jewish revolutionary spirit, or at least promoted, if it was written before the Jewish revolutionary spirit, promoted as a response to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I guess the Jones thesis makes the clear point that the Jewish rejection of Christ set them off on this path. And of course, then you have the destruction of the temple after 130, and then you have Talmudic Judaism. That's very different from Mosaic Judaism. But ever since then, the Jews have this penchant for revolutionary subversive behavior. It takes many forms. Like I said, it can be Freudianism, psychoanalysis. It can be Marxism or communism, social neoconservatism. It takes many forms, but nevertheless, it's always revolutionary and subversive. And if you read the works of Taylor Marshall, we'll talk about infiltration of the church and the problems, the scandals within the church, it's the church's apparent, you know, spiritual crisis that it's experiencing. Again, even Cardinal Vigano, who wrote a very interesting letter earlier this year about the deep state and Donald Trump, which I liked a lot. This was in regards to the COVID scamdemic, but he also talks about the problems within the church. And the bishop, Vigano, and people like Marshall, they don't identify particular groups that are involved, and also organizations that have addresses. You can you know, zip codes and phone numbers and names, and you can criticize the people. And but if you're not going to identify these groups because they're Jewish, you're not going to be able to play your part in the culture war that's been declared for the past 56 years. And we see why the church has been unable to deal with it, particularly since Nostra Aetate, confront this one important faction that seems hell-bent on, again, you know, destroying the culture and subverting the culture.
Well, you know, when he released his book Infiltration, where did he go on? Breitbart News. Mm-hmm. You know, a news agency that we read, one of its founders said its purpose was to defend Israel. He also was put on Fox News. It just seems bizarre, too, that this, I mean, for years he had worked at these Catholic schools and it had written these, you know, books that kind of had a marginal audience, but all of a sudden, Infiltration comes out and he's in, you know, on all these mainstream, you know, populist or post neoconservative.
And he doesn't talk about like Wim Hof's book, which I think is probably the most important books written in the past, you know, 50 years. You know, talk about infiltration control. You know, you're worrying about the Alta Vendita and Masonry. Yeah. Well, no, there's the CIA, there's C.D. Jackson, you know, stuff that, you know, the name, you know, there were, you know, people who are still living memory of. They don't have to. I think all in all, it's kind of the same thing, because I think you could say that CIA is sort of a Freemasonic infiltration because it's organized on those patterns, you know, secret societies, whatever. But my point is, and this is the point of some people who criticize Taylor Marshall's work is, and other people who again point to Freemasons and Illuminati and satanic influences. Now I think there are satanic influences. That's true, but they manifest themselves in things like the CIA and not, you know, Freemasonry. You know, because the CIA is still around. I don't know if Freemasonry is still around, but it's since they've achieved so much, it's largely. The lodge system, I don't think, is relevant to today's going on. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I once upon a time, I lived, let's say, in a high plains state. I guess that narrows it down. But I was speaking to a state legislator there, and he said, and I joked about Freemasonry, and he said, no, it's still pretty real here in the state government. I think there's pockets here and there, but if you drive by most lodges, they're like run down.
Mm-hmm.
like they're falling apart, or they're being sold off, or they're like renting themselves out so you can have a wedding there or something like that. I mean, Catholics, obviously.
Well, I mean, when you have a pope saying that separation of church and state is the ideal form of government, do you need to have secret societies? And these ideas have been embraced by so many people, just by, and we've internalized so much of these ideas. That's what the American Republic is about. It was a Freemasonic project from the get-go.
It's a point James Perloff made. I think is exactly right, that the Freemasonry that was big in the 18th and 19th century and early 20th century, and it transitioned into something else. It transitioned into the intelligence agency. So I have no doubt that there are, I mean, my view, it's ultimately, and, you know, it is a diabolical force that is in charge of this. I mean, that, you know, that there are, I think you and I were talking before we got on air, that, or maybe at the very beginning, about, like, there are families who are, from what I've heard, occultists, and they, you know, utilize the global system to bring about this sort of satanic new world order. It is
Malachi
about
Martin said that, whatever that's worth, but he talked about how, and I think he was one of these guys that I think told the truth a lot, but also sort of over dramatized things, because he was also pushing books, selling books.
There's a book written, I mean, there's a lot of accusations against Malachi Martin. I know E. Michael Jones has written about him. It's my conspiracy theory about him is that I think he may have seen some of these things. He may have really seen the Third Secret of Fatima. He may have been aware of some sort of consecration to Lucifer in, you know, Rome. I don't doubt that. I don't trust him. At one point, I know that there are people in the traditionalist movement who really look up to Malachi Martin. I don't trust him at all. I don't know if the accusations against him are true or not. But yeah, there's definitely a certain degree of sensationalism. And I think for a lot of these figures, you know, this is their life. They're selling, you know, books. But the idea that, you know, Freemasonry is the principal threat to Christian civilization today, I just don't agree with that. I could be wrong. I think you're right. There's something else. They've moved on.
I don't think it's ever irrelevant because I think the modern world is a Freemasonic creation. So I don't think you could ever say it's irrelevant, but I think now it's the next phase. And at its roots, there's a lot of, you know, the Jewish roots to Freemasonry are very interesting. So by focusing on Freemasonry, you're diverting attention away from perhaps you know, the important Jewish question which still confronts the West, which we're not allowed to ask because it's, you know, you're Adolf Hitler, you know, if you do it. But the church itself asked the very question in the 1890s, you know, in Civiltà Cattolica, on the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution. And they concluded that if you, you know, destroy the confessional state, dethrone the Catholic monarch, and you destroy the Catholic basis for your society, you will be controlled by Jews. That language is now considered, you know, crude and retrograde, and people wouldn't even, you know, they you know, blanch at it because, but back in the 1890s, the church, you read that article, it's like, whoa, it's like something, you know, some, you might read on the Daily Stormer or something, but I think it's essentially correct. If you look around you now, if you look at the culture, if you look at, you know, the banking system, and our society, it's been effectively been Judaized, which is the modern world. And Yuri Slezkind says that. That's what they say. They say the modern world is a Jewish world. So if you're not happy with the modern world, who do you target for criticism? It's like saying Hollywood. You know, some people will boast that Hollywood is run by Jews. You know, the movies it produced are run by Jews, and so they influence and they boast about it. There's a book written about it, an empire of their own. If that's the case, then Hollywood is a Jewish town and it is a Jewish creation, well, then they're responsible for it. So if you're not happy with Hollywood's impact on culture, then they're to blame. And they have to accept some responsibility. You can't have it both ways. It seems reasonable to me, that's all. I'm not, you know, just saying it's the Jews, you know, but I'm saying they admit that they have this disproportionate influence on things, and therefore they have to have some responsibility for how things are turning out if they're in so much control.
Yeah, there is a conspiracy, and allegedly St. Maximilian Kolbe had written about this, that Freemasonry was a Jewish invention, and the law, Freemasonry is kind of like an outer lodge for Gentiles. And it's a way, I mean, ultimately, you know, this kind of sounds rad-trad, but the idea of enlightenment, you know, this idea where our minds will be illuminated. One, as you pointed out, we are already the Illuminati in a certain sense. Like, who is Illuminati? All of us. Why? We have access to this encyclopedia of infinite information on the internet. Mm-hmm. We think of ourselves as above culture, above ethnic identity, that yes. we're so smart and we can mix together all the different religions together. And that's already been accomplished and achieved. And that
would make
that
a good bumper sticker, by the way.
Yeah, we
are.
We are
the Illuminati.
That's right. Put a t-shirt saying that. And it's, you know, I mean, like that now that we have the destruction of the old order, I mean, it's gone. You know, there was a, you know, last Catholic monarch with power, you know, Blessed Charles of Austria, and he was outfoxed and was not allowed to come back on the throne. We had Francisco Franco. Mm-hmm. Some people criticize him, but he, you know, you know what's interesting? Here's a conspiracy with him. Now, people on the left will say, oh, he was, you know, Opus Dei was involved in his administration. But supposedly Opus Dei was Americanizing his administration. Mm-hmm. And they supposedly sabotaged it. You know who was affiliated with Opus Dei throughout most of his career up until fairly recently? Taylor Marshall. Yeah. You know, I think in the past you have asked me about, there was one time I think you asked me about Opus Dei. And again, I'm not entirely sure, but it seems to be most of the time Opus Dei is Americanist.
Yes.
It's pro-capitalist. It's until recently, it was anti kind of, it seemed to be anti-Latin mass and anti-traditionalist. But there seems to be, that's when people have talked about, why is it Opus Dei seems to be working with some of these traditionalist groups? Something has changed, where they see that this is the new fertile ground, and some of these traditionalist groups and publications have been infiltrated. There's kind of this rapprochement where, you know, it's just like shocking some of the things that come out of traditionalist writers' mouths that in their own writings 10 years ago would be radically different.
Yeah, and you have sort of Opus Dei members who rise very high within the American empire. Like, absolutely. Wasn't Louis Free the FBI director at Opus Dei?
Well, there was that guy, they made a movie about him who was a spy. And oh,
the Robert Hansen case, yeah.
Yeah. And what's remarkable is the amount of CIA directors who were Catholic.
Yeah, the CIA was always in CIA has always been very good at recruiting Catholics and sort of integrating into the American system. And considering the efforts, the CIA, I mean, sorry, the FBI also working alongside the ADL.
Absolutely.
And so you have that, but yeah, it's a way of just, there's always been sort of incompatibility with Catholicism and the American system, but American Catholics have always had an inferiority complex with that, and so this is how they kind of get their place at the table within the system, and they become die-in-the-wool, you know, Americanists. You know, people like Justice Scalia, Louis Free, any judge, Amy Barrett's probably one too. I haven't examined her record, but I'm sure she's a pure Americanist. You see it in how they're treated when she's questioned. You know, your dogma. You know, what about your dogma? In a sense, they're kind of correct, but they're not. But they're correct for all the wrong reasons, like a Dianne Feinstein or a Blumenthal. They're correct for all the wrong reasons. Because no one ever asked, you know, no one asked Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Kagan or Breyer whether the Talmud would reflect how they interpret the law. That would be considered anti-Semitic, but they can't talk about your Catholic dogma about this. You know.
This is probably going to trigger some people, but there is some sense in which Talmudic Judaism flows well with the Enlightenment and the American ideal.
Yes.
You know, this idea that we will all become like gods.
Well,
and
proves, well, you know, a new order, a new
Yeah.
Novus Seculum. What's that? The Novus Ordo Seculum, Seculum. But the idea of revolutionizing the world. I mean, someone like talk about the rights of man. these things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's revolutionary, and of course the revolutionary spirit. And Benjamin Franklin, and he was an alchemist, and all these things. And this is something that's a bitter pill for many Americans to swallow, but perhaps we're seeing it play out now, the American experiment, as sort of the American system reaches its reductio ad absurdum, what we're witnessing today. So go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
And also the problem of subordinating the church when you have church and state. And I think I was listening to a Jay Dyer talk earlier this week, and he recorded, I forget, it was The Russian Statesman, I think was the book. I forget the writer's name, but he said, if you have separation of church and state, you don't have separation of church and state. What you have is the state dominates the church. So you don't get, although we have parchment guarantees for these rights and these things, they're really just parchment. They don't mean anything. If there is a separation church and state, the state will dominate the church. Whereas if there's a unity there, sort of what you have under a confessional system, a confessional state, and everyone in that society is Catholic, then the church will have power to check the state. But the American system is completely opposite from that. It wasn't even founded on those principles. America is America, but we do have European countries that were formerly that way, and they were overthrown by revolution. But even as recently as a Salazar or a Franco, who identified as a Catholic, leader, the Catholic Church undermined them, as you alluded to a few minutes ago. And Opus Dei was there, although Opus Dei supposedly was supported because Maria Escriva supported Franco, because the communists were raping nuns and burning churches and killing priests. So he obviously would pick Franco in that conflict. But Franco was a Catholic statesman, but he wasn't liberal. But when Spain adopts a liberal constitution, what happens to Spain?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will give some credit to Taylor Marshall in Infiltration. He does kind of weigh the different prophecies that are passed around the traditionalist movement about Our Lady of La Salette and the alleged vision of Pope Leo XIII, that the devil would sort of seize control of Rome. And if that is true, that there is some sort of satanic infiltration, which I think without a doubt there is, I mean, what would the church look like? How would it look any different than it does now?
Yeah.
And people have this desperation of Cardinal so-and-so will save us, or Archbishop so-and-so will save us. And as Americans, Catholics, we had Bishop Fulton Sheen. Some people criticize some of his statements on America. And there's John Paul II, who is at the very least a complicated figure. But we long for these individuals who are going to come and save us in the church, and my theory is, it could be wrong, if somebody is getting national attention and it's positive and there's this tremendous push behind them, I think we should at the very least give them a second glance. Mm-hmm. If someone's being promoted all over the media, and some of these figures, I won't name some of them by name, but I would just really urge people to take a look at them. They take a look at even what they're wearing and how it seems kind of set up, that the Pachamama thing, Taylor Marshall admitted to kind of planning that ahead of time, the dunking of the Pachamama with the guy, Alexander Shugel. Obviously these pagan idols should not be in the churches, but, we all kind of learned and got burned by the JP2 generation of all these Catholic celebrities. At least some of them ended up, committing scandals and that sort of thing. Don't think also that, in traditionalism, you can have people that are Latin mass and bring back the Catholic monarchy and whatever, these media people, some of them are brilliant, like Steve Bannon, some of them are not so brilliant, but they know what people want. They're, some of them at least are sophists in the sense of they put on the appearance, and they'll even, you know, the definition of a sophist, we usually think, you know, the ancient Greek sophists, they were liars. Not necessarily. Some of them use the truth to manipulate people. So they'll say things that are true to kind of get people like, you know, we got to vote for Trump. It's the end of the world. And, you know, Biden's going to put us in a, you know, camp. Now, that may happen. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it may happen that, you know, whoever is controlling Kamala Harris has got, you know, we got this list and we're going to start with these, you know, reactionary figures, and we're going to start working further, further to the left, and we're going to put these people in camps. That very well could happen. And it may be that it is a prudent thing to work for Trump. But what I guess my main point I've been trying to make is that, you know, Bannon laid out a plan to have this right-wing revival. It's going to be pro-capitalist, implicitly pro-Israel, and it's going to be something that is going to utilize the radical right, which they did to the alt-right, and then, you know, toss them to the side or abandon them or whatever. And it's my view that he has attempted to do this with, you know, the Catholic Church. He's very, very smart. He sees where people are. It's not going to work to sort of call up the old ghosts of, like, you know, the conservative Catholic movement anymore. But we have all these traditionalists, and we're going to push them to vote for Trump. You know, I don't know. I mean, Steve Bannon may have some sincerity to him. He may really believe what he says. He may really think he's doing the right thing. But there is, at least on some level with some of these people, some sort of manipulation going on.
Well, it's kind of the, you know, if you're just a, you know, an average schmuck on the street or some guy with a family and a job.
Yeah.
What side do you pick? I mean, obviously a Catholic for many reasons can't in good conscience or in standing vote for someone like Biden because of the, you know, particularly the abortion issue.
Absolutely.
But that's assuming you think voting matters, right? Which is you can say is a question. Figures like John Paul II, you know, he was sort of a trapped, you know, he was sort of recruited for the Cold War, and a lot of things I think went on. Perhaps he knew about it, perhaps he didn't, like the Vatican Bank and what the CIA was doing with Solidarity, and a lot of reasons why he'd support Solidarity, right? I mean, it's Polish. Yeah. He let a lot happen for the greater cause of defeating the evil empire. But he's someone, even a figure like Fulton Sheen, who was very close to Claire Booth Luce. And of course, she's married to Henry Luce, and that's the whole Time Life empire. And that's the skull and bones. That's the empire. You know, that's the system. That's the empire. And even Fulton Sheen on a show would talk about the evils of communism, which is all true, but he's not talking about the evils of Americanism, which supposedly that's what Vatican II was instituted, you know, to sort of not to adjust the church to the challenges of the modern world, particularly communication and TV and entertainment, which was, you know, rapidly developing in the 1950s and 60s. The TV set, I think, was it Father Finney who said that having a TV in your room is having a Jew in your living room? And that sort of harsh ethnic rhetoric is the type of healthy thinking I thought was necessary to deal, you know, with the problem. But that's, you know, I think he wasn't he defrocked for that or something?
Oh, Feeney?
Yeah.
Father Feeney?
Yeah.
I think it was an issue with, he argued, I could be wrong, and I'm not a theologian, but I think it was about, he argued that you had to be baptized to get to heaven.
Okay.
I think that was it. And I think Pat Buchanan talks about this in his, right from the beginning, where there were, the nuns had something from Father Feeney in class, and then Pius XII condemned him, and then they stopped teaching his material. And I think it's because he said something along the his belief was that you absolutely had to be baptized.
Okay.
There was no baptism desire or anything like that.
But that's sort of almost like he's almost Father Coughlin in the 30s and 40s. He was deep platformed. So much for free speech, right? Fighting for free speech, and he's the church, you know, works with the Roosevelt administration, deplatform, even like deny him mail services for his newspaper or his publication. But the priests like that sort of they reflected a sort of ethnic or street wise approach to the reality of the situation. And it might have been a product of also ethnic solidarity, ethnic identity, and also just practical experience that they could enunciate or express in their rhetoric. And people were more comfortable doing that prior to the Second World War. Older generations were talking about they dismissed as racist for some of the things they'd say. But some of the things they'd say were nevertheless, weren't necessarily untrue, you know. So, and this is all part of that ethnic, where we're, again, the sort of the Freemasonic attitude where we're all kind of melded into one people with no ethnic identity. And so we accept that and we're all one people, except we're not all one people because there's such thing as white privilege, right? And if you have groups that do maintain their ethnic network, their ethnic solidarity, their ethnic nepotism, and their identity, and use that, organize on that basis, create organizations on that basis, they're be in a position to get control of institutions, of society, and then subvert it or corrupt it. And I think that's what's happened, where all other ethnic groups, particularly the ones that are Caucasian, don't have any identity, can't have their neighborhoods, can't have their schools, can't have their sort of their... ethnic federalism, something that the country had in the early part of the 20th century, seemed to be a good modus vivendi, but it was smashed because those in power, the Anglo-American Zio power bloc, wanted the empire. And they got the empire with two world wars, and then they had to integrate and change everything. And integration itself is you think of it in terms of racial integration, but again, that's a narrative that they promoted to promote the policies to justify all the judicial activism and legislation. But what they were doing, they were smashing ethnic identity, particularly Catholic ethnic identity, so they could break the cultural and ultimately the political power of the Catholic Church, and unleash the cultural and sexual revolution of the 1960s, 70s, and we're still seeing today as it progresses further and further into insanity with LGBTQ and transgenderism, which gets us back into sort of this weird Masonic Gnostic idea that creation itself is an error, you know, and we are gods. We can actually recreate ourselves. We can actually deny our sex. We can pretend we're something else and demand the language and the laws indulge that fantasy, you know.
Yeah, I guess maybe a couple of final points here. I think that it's something Jay Dyer and I talked a little bit about off air, recently, then a little bit, about a month ago or so, I think. But the idea of overtly satanic evil infiltrating some of these groups is not off the table. You know, there's allegedly a book sort of written mentioning this, and I think that. When you look at this, how this revolution has progressed since the late Middle Ages in the West, that there is an ultimately sort of diabolical control over it. And these intelligences, whether people believe within demons or the devil or not, in my view, are far more intelligent than us and far more intelligent than any ethnic group or that sort of thing. And they're using all of these different movements. There's a short story by the Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges, and it's called Deutsches Requiem. And in there, it's like the meditations of an SS officer, and he's thinking about how the National Socialism will produce like this globalist system afterwards. So in the dialectic, in order to have open borders, you have to have before that German National Socialism and this sort of rabid, aggressive, and violent ethnocentrism. So it's the history is being worked out in this dialectic, mm-hmm. and all of these different, people have their kind of role, like chess pieces, almost being played. Like, what was the what has been the effect of, some of these church shootings or school shootings? Well, the Dylann Roof shooting, all of a sudden the Confederate flag is terrible. It's bad.
Yeah.
Walmart has to get rid of it.
It's like overnight.
Yeah, absolutely. They're ready to roll. And, you know, what is the effect of, you know, Charlottesville, this massive crackdown and censorship, and, you know, a certain sense, you know, separating, at least in the minds of some people, Trumpianism from, you know, the more radical edge of the alt-right. And so each one of these groups plays a role in this. And it's my personal view, and those who are not Catholic, you know, obviously will disagree, but I honestly believe we need a explicitly, you know, Catholic political entity under the sovereign reign of Christ the King, and all these other efforts are going to fail. I mean, in my view, the you know, age of paganism is over with. It's gone. That was in the past, and Christianity supplanted it. You know, obviously paganism has returned, but it's not the way forward to building a civilization, you know, for, you know, our families. And it's ultimately going to have to be specifically, explicitly Catholic. And all these people who work collaboratively with these different groups end up being played as suckers. You know, the Catholic neoconservatives took works written by Jewish neoconservatives and sold and rebranded them and rewrote them for Catholics. You know, these other, you know, if my theory is correct, these Catholic media outlets today are taking Breitbartism and rebranding it, and, you know, this neo-populism, or what Bannon called the global Tea Party, and, you know, reshaping it and selling it to Catholics. I mean, so we're, the Catholics are kind of the suckers. They're the, you know, underlings in this process. It's not the case that we're going to get mutual benefit. I could be wrong. It could be, you know, in, you know, 3 months, Roe versus Wade is struck down or something like that, which would be a miracle. That could happen. I don't know. And maybe voting for Trump is the best thing. But I just, from my research, I have enough, you know, evidence in my own mind in order to be at least cautious about Trumpianism when you look at the forces behind it.
Yeah, E. Michael Jones says that Trump was elected to destroy the American empire. That's God's way of doing it. And so God works through these things, although they may not even know they're doing God. We're all doing God's will, right, in a way. I mean, final analysis, right? And you know, you can look at things like, hey, there hasn't been a major war under President Trump.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. That's a good thing. He's pulling out of Afghanistan. That's a good thing. You could say that justify reelecting him just on based on that. You know, that's politics. Politics, you don't get everything you want, and you may not get much of what you want or what you think you want. That's also this is, you know, the cunning of reason, you know, as Hegel would call it. As and so all these forces, just even this COVID pandemic scam, it's exposed so much about the evil forces of the New World Order, the cabal, the hideous strength of the system, and now its fangs are bared for all to see, and it's forcing a lot of people to confront it. I mean, you get this cabal at Davos with their Great Reset plan, and they have videos talking about it. It's, you know, openly talking about radically changing society, denying people access to, you know, motor travel, electricity, you know, like, what do you think is going to happen if they do this? And, you know, it's not going to be everyone living in fields. No, it's be living in stack housing, or if you're not producing the energy, if you get away from fossil fuels and you're not producing the amount of energy you want, you're going to get poverty. And if you get poverty, you're going to get disease and a dying off. So ironically, you know, the Great Reset will create much more disease, because really disease is a function of relative living standards. The higher living standards you have, the less disease and sickness you have. The poorer you are, the sicker you are. And, you know, health doesn't come through a syringe or even the intervention of a doctor. It's higher living standards. That's what revolutionized living standards in the West was, you know, the creation of public sanitation, infrastructure, better diet, better living standards. It wasn't doctors or medical intervention. But this whole thing has exposed so much about the system that really it's creating, although it seems like a curse right now, it's an opportunity that we wouldn't have been given if they have kept it on a slow boil for a while. They've accelerated it for a reason, and in the process they've exposed themselves, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even 9/11, you know, there's horrific deaths, you know, those images of people jumping out of the building. But that red-pilled a lot of people. I mean, it red-pilled me, I think. I remember there was a conversation you had with Jay Dyer or something. You guys were talking about your red-pilling experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like people, you know, that opened the door to the whole conspiracy culture that, you know, took off in the, you know, in the last decade and continues to this day. And, you know, the 2008 economic crisis got people seriously questioning the economic system in which we live in. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the reactions to that was, you know, libertarianism. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement, I don't agree with everything they said or most of what they said, but that was a genuine movement. Why? Because they sent in the NYPD to beat the shit out of them. Excuse my language.
Yes.
You know, that's why we knew it was real. With these other groups, they're allowed to just run wild, you know, and even on the right, like who goes to jail and who doesn't, who gets into, like, that's clear where the power is. If you are, you know, immune from prison for your political activity, then you might be on, you know, somebody's payroll or something.
Yes, if you're getting money from Fortune 500 corporations, you're not a revolutionary group.
Absolutely.
Because the revolution itself is corporate funded from the top. And so now we have a situation where, I mean, yeah, it's where, you know, it's IBM, it's Coca-Cola, it's, you know, Apple Computers funding, giving money to these supposedly revolutionary organizations, which may give pause to think, wait, who are we fighting for here? You know, and that can switch very fast, by the way. It could switch, you know, it could be all of a sudden repression could be switched to the other side when it suits their purposes in the dialectic, you know.
Well, yeah, you'll see when Black Lives Matter gets out of line, they start to rein them in.
Yeah.
You know, they are Antifa or whatever. They, you know, obviously are totally AstroTurf groups. But, you know, once they start taking power in their own hands and going after untouchable figures, which I think they did to a president of a university mm-hmm. last week. If you start you saying the wrong things and naming the wrong people, you know, and even in the Black community, too, I don't want to keep, you know, laboring on here into the night with my rambles. But even in the Black community, you'll see which movements, again, I don't agree with a lot of their views, but which ones are genuine and which ones are fake, which ones get shut down. Mm-hmm. And are, you know, humiliated or blocked or whatever, and which ones are encouraged. And that's an important thing for people to recognize. And also, when do you see an intersectionality between right and left on certain issues? You know, when you see like both sides supporting some issue, it may not necessarily be something good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting how this whole thing with the COVID 19 pandemic is with Trump supporting the vaccines. Now people on the left are doubting vaccines.
Yeah, that's so crazy. It's so bizarre that he's to blame for it. Like somehow he caused the COVID, or like if we were to shut down more of the country sooner or something, like it's somehow he's to blame. Like shutting it down will, you know, eventually allow for people to get back to work. And I do. And you know, I take this seriously. I know people individually who are really suffering right now, mm-hmm. you know, because of the shutdown. But some of them blame Trump. It's like Trump's fault somehow that COVID, you know, would not have adversely affected them as badly without Trump. And it's important to think outside. And that sounds like a 1990s like school message, but think outside the box. And, you know, really, I would encourage, especially the Catholic listeners, to really look at some of these media outlets and look at, like, what are they promoting? You know, is this genuinely Catholic?
Yeah.
You know, or is there something going on here? And again, I'm not accusing anyone of being totally disingenuous. I don't think anyone is. Even Taylor Marsh, I don't think he's totally disingenuous or something like that. But that there are other forces at work here.
Yeah, I mean, they're imbued with the spirit of 1776. You know, they've been raised, and that's kind of how they view things. And I understand, you know, because that's how I was raised to think, too, about, you know, that's how to interpret history. But, you know, you get a little older, a little wiser, get more reflective about these things. It isn't quite that cut and dry or simple. And, you know, and I guess from the standpoint of American Catholics, is, they should seek the conversion of all people, of all nations. And that's, thinking that we need to have separation of church and state, tolerance of all religions. The problem, philosophically, when you tolerate all religion, what you're saying is you have to tolerate all errors. And so if all religions are the same, that's like saying, all truths are the same. You create a moral anarchy, is what you seem to have. It's problematic with America, because of America's founding. It is what it is. It's a Masonic Frankenstein monster. It's just the history books will interpret it in a certain way, but maybe 500 years from now, if we're still around, that sort of thing. But it's just one of those things. It's the inner contradictions of the American system, of Americanism, what it represents in history and into the world. But when you embrace Americanism and you think that America is the be-all and end-all, and that it's the perfect system and you can't criticize it, it's there to liberate the world. Just think about what agenda you're supporting when you start thinking about that. It also requires a reevaluation of sacred historical events, like the world wars and how Americans view their country. And for the average person who doesn't reflect on these things or just expects or has imbibed a sort of a textbook view of history, it's just completely incomprehensible to rethink these things.
Yeah, I mean, Leo XIII wrote Condemning Americanism, but he also wrote, that there's a certain sense in which, in the late 19th century, Catholics were treated well in the United States. And there is, my mother's side of the family is Protestant and, goes back to Jamestown eventually. I'm not in the Illuminati, I promise. I personally have a great deal of love for our land and even, a very strong American identity, especially, when Europeans, talk down about our country or whatever, do have a love for it. But it is true that these ideas like liberalism, I've said this before, liberalism was understood as like liberation from the church. Laissez-faire economics is like freedom from the Christian restrictions on economics. Mm-hmm. And that our country was born. I mean, what do you think President George W. Bush meant when he was talking about in his second inaugural address, there's an ancient hope that's meant to be fulfilled? What is he talking about there? That's just weird. I mean, like what is he, I don't know if someone else wrote that or whatever, but this idea, this Masonic idea that, whether he was a Mason or not, that, the world, we're going to have a world republic.
Yes.
We're going to have Star Trek and everyone's going to be free and all the ethnicities will be mixed together. It'll be like the ancient Egyptians and, we will have this Luciferian religion where we'll all become gods. But the reality of that, it's like the false promises of communism and the false promises of certain forms of capitalism is that, it's not going to be a pleasant, experience. It's going to be a totalitarian system ultimately. And ironically, all the kind of like Mad Max tier survivalist conspiracy culture may turn out to be, I could be wrong, may turn out to be wrong, and that it's going to be the Brave New World instead, where you get up in the morning and take pills and go on, a bus to work in Soros widget factories, and then you come home and then you like LARP as a Star Wars action figure or something like that and take more drugs and go to bed.
Yeah, and of course, they've gotten... They've accelerated that with the whole fourth industrial revolution idea of Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum. And it's funny how this the lockdown and the supposed containment measures to deal with this horrific virus that kills less people than the seasonal flu, reason for truly overturning society, upending everything and shutting everything down. How it gets us toward that with everyone online, students staring at a computer screen all day, not going to class, all cultural events. No one's going to church, or at least you don't have to anymore, according to the bishops, because if you're afraid of a bug. Churches have capacity restrictions, so they really can't really serve their real function, or at least can't serve as many people, so the parish dies. It kind of rots away and dies, withers away, because you don't have any parish events, church events. You can't have orchestras or cultural events, you know, these things. You Fauci talking about you may not want to do Thanksgiving, ooh,
Gosh,
Christmas. I
goodness.
mean, this is insane, you know. But we're putting up with it because we're afraid of a little bug, because ultimately we're afraid of death because we don't believe in God anymore. You know?
Yeah, but ultimately, I guess, I believe Christ is the Lord of history. And, I've said this before, there are lots of good people out there. I found this, during this whole COVID thing this past year. I've traveled a lot throughout the country, and there are good people out there, and there are people who are awake. And in the church, there are good, there are still good priests.
Yeah,
I
you
mean,
can watch
like,
them on YouTube.
yeah,
Yeah.
it's, I mean, people talk about being blackpilled about all this corruption in the church, and certainly I know, as a journalist, a lot of it, and to see that it extends throughout all these different, movements in the church that were supposed to be reforms or reactions or whatever. But, ultimately, personally, my faith is in, our Lord Jesus
Yeah.
Christ and, his power to overcome this evil. I mean, whatever, the authenticity of some of these prophecies or alleged prophecies or whatever, and all these end times things, nonetheless, we know that we'll go through this period of chastisement, and that, like there is probably something to these claims that there'll be this sort of diabolical influence in the church, some sort of reign of Antichrist. I don't know if that's where we're in now. And I don't know what form that reign will take, but this is something we've been warned about, and we've been told we were given the grace to make it through it, and I think we will.
Okay, Jesse. Well, thanks for coming on the show. We'll say good night.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I could have loved. mankind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better. Didn't mean to be unkind.